You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the second half of a two-part episode recorded on location at the BFI South Bank, at the launch of the DFC, the first new children's comic in a generation that isn't based on a TV show or toy range, or has to rely on bundle gifts to sell issues. I'm talking to John Aggs, the illustrator of Philip Pullman's strip for the DFC, about his hopes for the comic, his love of the medium, and his thoughts on black representation sequential art. And I'm also talking to Patrice Aggs, John's mother, with whom she's creating another strip called The Boss. And finally, I'll be talking to Jim Medway, author of the strip New at the Zoo. I'm talking to John Aggs, the illustrator of Philip Pullman's comic strip in the DFC. What's your background in doing comics? Have you done sort of adventure comics before? Is this a fairly new venue for you?
Well, I'm a manga artist, really, and although this comic shouldn't be seen as manga, it's not. It's got much more French bande dessinée influences in it. I won a Rising Stars of Manga competition a while ago, and I've been doing a lot of Japanese influence stuff before that. I think adventures comics I've always loved a good sort of ripping yarn, although this is the first time I've actually done a completed adventure story. This is something that I've always been interested in.
When it came to the kind of manga strips you did then, presumably that they were one-off tales that told a complete story in a short number of pages. Was that a discipline that helped you when it came to working with other people, that you've got an episodic comic that obviously has to have a beginning and a middle and an end, as well as a cliffhanger?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think manga is probably really poor discipline for doing a weekly comic. I mean, I did a comic for the Guardian, which is also going to be run in the DFC, called Robot Girl, which I lent a lot more on my manga influences. And to be honest, it really didn't work quite so well. And so it's actually quite good to have someone like Philip writing it, who has a very good grasp of where a cliffhanger should fall and exactly how much you should have in a week-long story. I mean, I often have to say to him that he might sort of trim it down a little so that I have more space to draw in what has to be drawn. But really, his writing helps to usher on the story very well in ways that I wouldn't have if I was left to my usual manga devices, which is a much, much more laid-back pace.
I suppose one thing that manga's famous for is that it does have kind of a cinematic pacing. Traditional comics, for example, you know, if someone was riding a bike from one part of the city to the other, they might just show the beginning, a frame representing the middle of the journey and a frame representing the end. While in a manga book, because they can go on for like hundreds of pages, it might fill, you know, a couple of pages. So it has this kind of sedate cinematic pace. But presumably with the DFC, it's a traditional kind of kids comic where it's six or seven different stories, all of which occupy, I don't know, you know, a sixth of the comic. And there are a variety of stars nestling next to each other.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and definitely. However, if you look at Kate Brown's Spider-Moon, which is very laid-back, sort of proper manga pacing, and then you've got James Turner's Animal Adventure Squad, which is one page of absolute furious action per week. And so it jumps back and forth, and I think that's really the charm of the DFC, is that it's so all over the place, really, with different styles and influences. And as David quite rightfully said, if you don't like one thing, you'll like something else, because it's not a boys' comic of action and thrills as they were back in whenever it was we last saw comics in this country. There's a lot of variety in that.
And why do you think over the last 10, 20 years there haven't really been comics for kids in this country?
Oh, that's a really difficult one. A lot of people would sort of blame that on television or video games or all these other things that are much more interesting for children, but stories never really go out of style. And I think the death of children's comics has really been that you have to pay your artists too much. It just costs so much money. Why not just make a photo comic? Or not even a comic at all? Why not just stuff it and use recut pictures of Bart Simpson in order to make a comic? I think David has really worked out a formula with a company like Random House. You've got the money there to be able to pay artists a decent rate, a rate from which you will get good artwork, and to be able to make it financially acceptable. I think the only reason that comics went away is just the money. It's not the kids. Kids haven't changed. It's just that it costs too much. You can't rip people off the way you used to be able to.
And also, over the last 20 years, reviewers and critics of children's literature almost seem to see comics as a bad word. Because if you look at, say, the work of Raymond Briggs, things like The Snowman, When the Wind Blows, Fungs the Bogeyman, they're comics. And no one ever says that Raymond Briggs is the guy who creates comics.
Yeah, Raymond Briggs is sort of apart from that. I mean, when the thing is when the US was having the comic book code emplaced upon it, which basically killed comics of any interest other than superheroes in the US, the UK adopted a similar thing, which was that, that basically comics were just written off as actually being bad for you. You know, bad for your reading and development. And now the climate has changed. Thanks mostly to Harry Potter, actually, because as soon as Harry Potter came along, all of the editors suddenly turned to look at all of their smaller writers and the people they've been neglecting for years, thinking, Christ, did we overlook a Harry Potter in here? We've got to go back and check all this stuff out again. And comics is the next sort of wave of that, where people are thinking, well, actually, these were really popular with the Beano and the Eagle and Picture Post before that, and you know, all of these sort of wonderful things, and so maybe we should be reassessing that. And Harry Potter really pointed out that there is money in children, in children's industry. You know, there's cash there, and it's made a lot of people reassess the situation. I David Fickling is very different. I think he's really prepared to go out on a limb on comics. I think if I was in his situation, I would be terrified that this wasn't going to work, but that's probably why I'm not a publisher, so I can't take those risks.
Or at the very least, you think he'd be publishing it in manga format, because that seems to be the perceived idea of what kind of kids and sort of teenagers, to use a horrible word, are into these days.
Yeah, I'm glad David has really picked up on the fact that you need to have some manga in there, because manga is the new cool. But I think regardless of the cultural influences and whether it looks Japanese or not, a good story is a good story and it will carry the whole thing through. I don't think kids from... I mean, the comic is for 8 to 12-year-olds. And really, there is nothing story-based in a comic format for 8 to 12-year-olds. Manga picks up for... You know, the people like Tokyopop come in and grab them when they're... I don't know... 17, 16, 15, but before that, there's nothing but the Beano. There are no stories in comic format, and really, it's easy to ask or to think, how could this possibly fail, really? Because it's like, here's an example, Doctor Who, right? A lot of people, when Doctor Who, they said they were bringing back Doctor Who, said, oh, I don't know, you know, kids, they don't like Doctor Who nowadays, they like really sort of shiny, spanky, awesome-looking things. But Doctor Who is a tried-and-tested formula that kids really love. Bringing it back couldn't have failed, and look, it didn't fail. The comic, the kids' comic, the Eagle worked, the Beano worked, the Dandy worked, and suddenly there's nothing. And you bring back a story comic which is much closer to the Eagle, it's not like you're competing against licensed characters. Licensed characters just sort of tell weak stories. We're telling proper, new, original stories here.
When it came to the manga strips that you drew before the DFC, what kind of age group were you pitching them at?
Oh, I was pitching them at a teenage audience, a sort of Tokyopop audience, basically anyone who'd buy. I did do a couple more adult stories, and I do love to write adult stories and draw adult stories when I can, but really I have a sort of a general love of comics, of telling stories in panels, of drawing silly things in boxes, so the age group doesn't really concern me that much.
And were there any particular artists who influenced your style?
Obscure or okay,
as obscure as you like.
I like a great comic, a great French bande dessinée called Al Togo, which
that's
is
well done.
which is by Morvan and Savoya, yeah, and that's fantastic. I like that a lot because it's actually got a black protagonist, and it makes no point about the fact that he's black. He just is. And French comics rarely ever do that. In fact, any comics rarely ever do that. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the pacing in that as well. I'm a big fan of Otomo, and I use a lot of influence on that in the John Blake strip. You may scratch your head and wonder how I could be influenced by Otomo in a weekly comic of 5 pages. I draw a lot from him. Also, Hergé, Winsor McCay, and I really like Olivier Vatine. A melting pot of people. Mostly French. More so French than Japanese, despite the fact that I'm often described as a manga artist.
Since you brought the subject up, as a mixed race artist, when you were creating your own strips, and I don't know if it's a discussion you had with Philip at all, did you try to have representation of minorities in your comic, considering that comics in general seem to be very white, both on the page and behind the pen?
Philip has a number of black characters in his script, both male and female, and those were already laid out before I started, but generally I avoid drawing black characters because they're really hard to draw. And this is just a fact. If you look at any comic representation of a white male, let's say, the distortion that is applied to that white male to arrive at the comic caricature, which is effectively what it is, if you applied those same rules and that same process to a black character, you'd end up with a caricature that was completely unacceptable. So a black character has to be somewhere in between completely photorealistic and a slight caricature. And let's face it, black people, like myself, have wider noses and thicker lips and you know, less of a chin, you know. You can't caricature that. It's just not socially acceptable to apply the same rules that you would to a white character. So it's difficult. It's difficult territory, you know, especially when dealing with kids' comics as well, because you want the kids, whatever race they are, to be able to associate with at least one character in the strip. But at the same time, you can't risk offending anyone with these sort of stereotypes. And the same thing goes for Asians, Hispanics, anyone who isn't white and male.
I mean, I think it's very telling that, for example, one of the most high-profile black characters in comics is Nick Fury in the Ultimate Universe, and they've drawn him basically as Samuel L. Jackson.
Nick Fury is white. I'm sorry. When did Nick Fury suddenly... If you want a new black character, Marvel, in case you're listening to this, make a new black character. Just invent a new one, you know? I mean, what happened to Blade when he had his Shaft haircut? Man, that rocked. And then you had, you know, the Black Panther. He was fantastic. You know, just invent a new character rather than just saying, oh, God, we're not representing enough ethnic diversity here. Let's just change someone into a black guy. I'm sorry, I disagree with that. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There was a Marvel tradition of just drawing a white character and then colouring them black in order to make them a black character. And very few artists have the talents or the nerve in order to represent a black character as they should be, to get that caricature right on the money so that it looks cartoony enough to fit with the whole Marvel or... style, but not so cartoony that it's insulting.
And your strip in the DFC, how many issues is it running for?
I think the first arc is 13, 14 issues, I think. And then there's probably more. It depends, really, on Philip, on how much he's prepared to do before he goes back to writing The Book of Dust, I think, is his next project.
Now I'm torn, because I'd love to read a regular comic by Philip Pullman, but I'd also love to read The Book of Dust.
I really want to read The Book of Dust, so I'm hoping he keeps up with this for a while and then sort of loses interest and goes back to writing The Book of Dust, because I think it's going to be fantastic.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right. No problem.
I'm talking to Patricia Aggs, artist and writer of The Boss in the DFC.
John and I collaborate on the writing. He has mainly done most of the writing, but I think we collaborate on how the thing is going to look, and perhaps if the story isn't quite working in the way we hoped it would, but he actually does the physical words in the speech balloons, and the tracking of the action throughout the story.
And what's the story about? If you're allowed to say.
I think if you think Emil and the Detectives for the 21st Century, a book that I loved and he also loved when he was the right age to read it.
Cool. If you were to describe your own art style, what are your influences as a comic book artist?
I'm an American. I've never read the Beano. I've never read the Dandy. I grew up on American comics. I absolutely loved American newspaper comics in particular. And as I'm the same generation as Philip Pullman, I will remember the Superman and Marvel comics that he read. But I also, because I grew up in the States, had access to newspaper comics, which were things like Blondie and Dagwood, Terry and the Pirates, Mary Perkins on Stage, Dick Tracy, all the things that American kids would know a lot about and English kids would know nothing about. But it's a good strand to weave into British comics, the American newspaper tradition in particular. I did a book with Philip Pullman, graphic novel. I didn't realise it was 1991. I said to Philip when I saw him, it was really fun, that book we worked on. That must have been 10 years ago. He said, more like 20. So, yeah, time does fly by. But, no, it's very good that sort of John's come in, following in my footsteps. He is a great, great person to work with. I was waiting all the way through his art school career until the moment when he was able to work with me, because we work really well together. He has got fantastic storytelling ideas. I will come up with something incredibly wacky that doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's a germ of an idea, and he will actually turn it into something that makes sense, and that, you know, you get the sort of germ of an idea and you can run with it. And we collaborate really well. He's still living at home at the moment, not because he wants to, but because he hasn't had time to find anywhere else to live. When he gets a moment and he goes, I will be bereft, because I love having him in the next door studio to knock on the door and say, John, can you help? When I've got a problem trying to sort out ideas for the next bit of the story or the next kind of illustration I'm going to do. He's a great guy.
When John was growing up, were you encouraging him to create comics?
Not really. I mean, our entire family are artists. Right, his father is a painter, landscape painter, and we have always drawn in our family as a matter of course. It's just what we do. It wasn't considered to be... In fact, it would have been unusual if everyone didn't draw all the time. My daughter's an artist as well. So, it's just what happened.
So if he'd said, Mum, I'm going to do physics, you can't make me do art.
I think I probably would have been slightly relieved, because I think I would love to, you know, understand physics myself. But I'm afraid it's obviously genetic.
Actually, having said that, I know someone who does theoretical physics and draws comics, so I've just defeated my own argument. One thing that seems really interesting about the DFC, apart from the fact that there's a variety of genres under one cover, is there seems to be a very international influence throughout the publication. I mean, Philip Pullman grew up in Australia. John and Kate both say that they have sort of Japanese manga influences on their art. For a long time, comics seem to be very much concentrated on the style of their birth, but now there seems to be this international dialogue between countries when it comes to creating comics.
Well, thank goodness. I do think possibly America and Japan have been probably more isolated than they should be for longer. But in Europe is so small, really. The bande dessinée tradition has got to influence people in England. And the fact that nowadays they're dragging the influences from further afield can't but be a good thing. It's fantastic. I mean, we've all been influenced by Tintin. I mean, Hergé's a god. We all know this. We all want to do something as good, really.
And you also worked in animation. You worked on the Snowman, someone was telling me. Was that your background before you did comics, or did you do them sort of side by side?
The Snowman was probably the best fun I've ever had. But it was chaotic and wonderful, and it was, as you can imagine, before the days of computers. Everything was drawn by hand, and the team that were working on that film had a terrific time. It was wonderful. But life moved on. We had to do other things. We had to eat. We had to pay the bills. I've done children's books. I've done etchings. I've done children's magazines, almost everything you can think of since then, basically to pay the school fees and get things sort of, get my career sort of carrying on. Comics has always been my first love, and it is fantastic that now there is suddenly the opportunity to go back to what I love to do best.
Well, I mean, it's funny because I was just saying to John that comics for children have been around for years, but they were almost hidden from view because, like, Raymond Briggs is a great comic book creator, but no one ever talks of him in those terms.
And Percy Simmons.
Yeah.
I know Percy Simmons not necessarily writing for children. Raymond Briggs possibly not entirely writing for children, as later work has not been aimed at the young things. But why not? Why is this enormous silence? Someone explain it. I don't understand it. Really don't.
David's kind of experiment, to give it a term. Do you think it's going to be successful? Has the gap in the market just been due to the fact that an entrepreneur hasn't exploited it?
The children of today do not know what they're missing. We all grew up with comics. It's very, very sad that a whole generation has missed out. So thank goodness someone has stepped in to show this generation what they're missing. They're going to love it. They can't help but love it. We all loved it.
Thinking of your previous work, is any of it still in print that our listeners might be able to track down?
I've done an awful lot. I've worked for probably every publisher in Britain at one stage or another. I've kind of lost track of what I've got up to at the moment. My last book was probably called Strawberry Squirt, published by O'Brien Press, and I can't probably go very much further back than that because it's been chaotic. It's quite fun having a chaotic life as an illustrator. Something different around the corner every few minutes, basically.
And presumably Strawberry Squirt was more of a traditional children's illustrated book with sort of separate text and pictures.
Yes, but I think almost every children's book I've illustrated, I have wanted to put speech balloons in and usually told that I couldn't. So they're all written and designed as if they would have speech balloons if it was possible. I think like a comic book person. I've always thought like a comic book person. Thank goodness nowadays I'm able to write and draw like a comic book person.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm talking to Jim Medway, one of the creators for the DFC. I was wondering, if you're allowed to, could you talk a little bit about your strip?
Okay, well, the first four strips I've got, it's a story called New at the Zoo, and it's basically a very simple joke repeated over and over again, which involves trainee zookeeper getting his instructions mixed up. So instead of giving carrots to the rabbits, he gives the parrots to the rabbits, and so on and so on. And it amuses me, so I'm hoping it amuses kids as well. After that, DFC is going to be running Crab Lane Crew, which is hopefully an ongoing strip, which is about a group of kids and kind of stuff they do kind of in between school and tea time or during the holidays. It's not going to be adventure, it's not going to be science fiction or fantasy, it's just a bunch of kids kind of entertaining themselves and climbing trees and all the things that kids are hopefully still interested in doing. So.
And what sort of format is your comic? Because I understand the DFC is going to be a mixture of lengths of stories. There'll be like single page gag strips, there'll be longer installments of like 5 or 6 pages. Since your comics seem to be more humour based, what sort of length are they going to be on a regular basis?
Well, the new at the Zoo, they're single pages, they're standalone, but they kind of follow into each other. The Crab Lane Crew is going to be, it's going to start off with single pages. But it's not actually a huge amount of space to tell a story, so hopefully it's going to progress to double spreads, which will give me a bit more space to kind of, you know, just get some story out in there. So we'll see. Hopefully the response will be positive. I do a lot of work in schools. I run comic workshops, mainly through Manchester Art Gallery. So I'll go into primary schools and I'll work with 10, 11-year-olds, which is pretty much the target group for the DFC. And I've been testing characters out on them and getting kids' responses, kids' ideas about what these characters might do with their time, kind of food they eat, kind of jokes they play on each other, this kind of thing. So that's, you know, quite a nice advantage. But one thing I've noticed is that kids I've worked with, they don't actually read comics. They might read TV tie-in stuff or film tie-ins, Simpsons, this kind of stuff. But very few of them have read Tintin or Asterix or all these things that you kind of assume that kids should have read. So I think the DFC is quite a refreshing, you know, breath of fresh air. I wish it all the best, I really do.
Well, I mean, it's funny, this seems to be a theme that keeps coming up, that comics seems to be a medium that's very much compartmentalised. So people who read superhero comics but they don't read any other genres, if there are good kids' comics out there, they're sort of buried in children's sections and aren't sort of advertised as comics. Why do you think that is? Because other sort of media like film, TV, literature without speech balloons seems to be something that people can dip in and out of genres, while comics seems to be something where you choose your bit and you stick to it.
I don't know, I think it's in relation to children's comics. I think it's not that kids have stopped reading comics, it's that they've stopped making comics for kids. If you go in Jim Hanley's universe in New York, amazing comic shop, you know, there's a massive kids section. You go in Gosh in London, which is a great comic shop, again they've got a good quality kids stuff. You go in any other comic shop, you really struggle to find stuff that's meant for kids. You don't see kids in these shops, and I just think that's such a shame. You know, if I walked in and picked a Spider-Man off the shelf, it wouldn't make any sense, because, you know, I don't know the backstory, I don't know the characters or the parallel universe, and you know, I just don't enjoy that kind of comic at all. I've been brought up on Beano and Dandy books, Jumble Sale finds, you know, that's where I got my reading material. But also other kids' books, Richard Scarry, all the books that he did, it's a big influence on me, myself. I don't know, I think kids are kind of missing out on a lot of good stuff. I'm quite excited by some of the Cinebook stuff that's coming out. Lucky Luke, you know, these are just reprints of French, you know, key stuff that French kids have been growing up with for years and years. But I'm hoping some of that filters through to schools, you know. It'd be nice to see that in school libraries and stuff, but, you know, we'll see.
Well, fingers crossed. So which artists would you say were an influence on your style? Children's books, illustrators, and classic Beano artists?
Children's books, definitely Richard Scarry. Janet and Alan Ohlberg, everything they've ever done has just been perfect. Comics-wise, I guess Leo Baxendale. I don't know, I was never really into kind of comics culture, but it was more like I say, you know, Jumble Sale finds. So a lot of the stuff I didn't know the artists' names, because it'll be in a 1968 Topper annual. You know, and I'm only just starting to have access to information about these characters. I guess that's one of the nice things about comics now, is that things are being reprinted and written about and discussed. So I've been doing a bit of research on Colonel Blink. He was in the Beezer from like 1950 to 1980. I'm just finding out about him, you know, but all of a sudden now you do have access to these resources, the information, so you can find out a bit more about characters and creators. So.
Well, it's interesting actually that the launch of the DFC is in the NFT, because in a way comics reminds me a bit of art house cinema. The art house cinemas are closing left, right and centre, and yet it seems to be something that's going underground. You get more and more pubs showing experimental films to an appreciative audience, and it's the same with comics. There are bad comic shops, like ones I won't mention on air, and good ones like Gosh and Page 45 and Orbital and whatnot, and yet they seem to be by the fans for the fans, and the mainstream seems to have abandoned them. I mean, hopefully the DFC is something that will cross that boundary.
I hope so. I mean, there's that idea that you know, subtitled art house films are good for you, you know, like cod liver oil, they've got to taste a bit horrible for it to work. And maybe there's a bit of that with comics as well. I'm not sure. I just think it'd be nice to get kids aware of the material that's out there, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, continuing the film metaphor, I used to work in a video shop, and the one thing that would make me angry more than anything else are bad kids' films, because parents will just rent anything out that's well marketed. even if it's technically bad for their kids. You know, and I think it's probably the same with comics, that there are all these licensed comics that seem attractive to parents because they come with a free gift. But ones that are actually good, like Lucky Luke and whatnot, parents just don't know about because they're not well marketed enough.
That's the thing. Maybe it's educating the parents as well, isn't it? I think the DFC have been targeting parents a lot with this recent campaign at Radio 4, The Guardian, all that kind of coverage. It's not been aimed at the kids, it's been aimed at the parents. And I guess the thinking is it's the parents that buy the Philip Pullman book or the Jacqueline Milson book, and they're the ones that hopefully are going to pay for subscription to the DFC.
Well, and obviously the Random House connection doesn't hurt.
Oh, of course, definitely. Yeah, I think it's so exciting, and I don't think it would have ever happened. It would have never got to the ground if it wasn't for Random House and David Fitklin's enthusiasm and, you know, his vision, I guess.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Okay.
In the next episode of Panel Borders, I'll be talking to up-and-coming artists Kate Brown, who also draws for the DFC, and Paul Duffield, artist of the online steampunk comic Freak Angels. Both Kate and Paul also illustrate manga Shakespeare, and I'll be talking to them about what it's like working with such differing writers. You'll be able to find that right here at www.panelborders.com. Thanks for listening.